So he goes in, endeavors to engage her in caresses, which still are unreproved if undesired. She doesn't say no, and she doesn't say yes. She just kind of sits there like a patient, either eyes upon the table, right? She's just sitting there. Which still are unreproved if undesired. Flushed and decided, he assaults at once. Exploring hands encounter no defense. Grope, grope. His vanity requires no response. His vanity requires no response. Now, I had a sort of an ornery childhood, and that, boy, vanity requires no response. And I know what they start talking about. Vanity requires no response and makes a welcome of indifference, because as long as there is indifference and there's no, this person not saying anything, he can think he's the big lover. He's the hot, he's the real hot dog. His vanity requires no response. She doesn't have to respond at all, because he's so much locked up in this vain thing in his own world, what he thinks is going on. And so there, again, game of chess. Is there any real touching going on here? And somehow this guy, these people manage to have intercourse, or something, you wouldn't even say intercourse, but or just say intercourse, without touching. The vanity requires no response. She doesn't give it. It's complete indifference. Is there lust? He's doing something in his head. Unreproved, if undesired, flushed and decided, he assaults at once, exploring hands, encounter no defense. His vanity requires no response and makes a welcome of indifference. Ouch. And I, Tiresias, if for suffered all, and acted on this same divan or bed, I who sat by Thebes below the wall and walked among the lowest of the dead. And then the young man carbuncular, after it's all over, it just happens in a parenthesis of Tiresias. About that much time, he's done. So he gets up, zips up, and says, he bestows one final patronizing kiss. Patronizing, right? Patronizing. Can you see this? The guy, she's lying there like a patient, he thrives upon the table, and he says, well, sweetheart, you're lucky. You're a lucky girl, baby. See you again next week. Same time, same station. Right? That's what this patronizing thing, patronizing. Well, you're lucky. You're just lucky to be in my presence. Dutz. Patronizing kiss, and then, that cool exit, right? But then the stairs unlit. And so Elliot has his joke here. Of course, Tiresias is blind, and Tiresias is good too. But Elliot has his joke as he goes, gropes, makes the cool exit, and then stumbles out the hall. She turns. Now what happens with her? She turns and looks a moment in the glass, hardly aware of her departed lover. And what's the tone of lover? Huh? Oh, irony again. She turns and looks a moment in the glass. It's just like, oh yeah? What was that? I thought I felt something. Did somebody bump me? No, this isn't, I'm really driving this because I want this thing to stick in your head. Really stick in your head. She turns and looks a moment in the glass, hardly aware of her departed lover. Her brain allows one half-formed thought to pass. One half-formed thought. Apparently she's not too bright, and the thought has not really come, but one half-formed thought to pass. Well, now that's done, I'm glad it's over. I don't know. Well, when lovely lady stoops to folly and finds too late that men betray, that's from the real song, from Goldsmith's song in Vicar of Wakefield, where when lovely woman stoops to folly and finds too late that men betray, and it goes on down, the only recourse is to die. That's from the real thing. In the old days, that was sort of the thing. Shame. Real shame. What is her thing? When lovely lady stoops to folly, her response to this whole thing, she paces about her room again alone. She smooths her hair with automatic hand, just like an automaton. That's over. Well, that's done. Puts a record on the gramophone. Puts a record on the record player. This music crept by me upon the waters. And along the strand up Queen Victoria Street, oh city, city, I can sometimes hear beside a public bar in Lord. People are at this point, there's not much hope at all. Now, the question 14 was, did we talk about this at all? I don't think we did on the question 14. Tiresias footnote on line 218, what is the substance of the poem? He says the substance of the poem is in what Tiresias sees. That's one of his footnotes. And Tiresias sees most clearly that creatures are dead to meaning, purpose, conviction, passion, life, fertility. Dead to this, a lovemaking, and no one touched anyone. It's a whole series of you know, intercourse, and no one touched anyone. No person to person, you know. I mean, remember your Tournier. No person to person here. There's nothing. Nothing. Their vanity requires no response. Each is a solipsist with what is real is what's inside my head, and that's that. And there's nothing outside that can really touch. Okay, in the legend, Tiresias was struck blind for thinking women had more pleasure than men in lovemaking. So what? Well, if that's true, we know how much pleasure she got out of it. So what about him? In this clerk typist thing, she gets none, so he must have not even known what he did. He must have been so wrapped up in his head that he didn't even, I mean, there wasn't anything going on. Did he ever get out of his mind? Did he ever really get out of his mind? Well, I think it's good to remember that that kind of lovemaking is masturbation, and I don't, you know, it's, in a sense, I don't think he did. He never got out of himself. No, he didn't. Vanity requires no response and requires no subject. It only requires an object.
Hey, John?
Yeah.
Patricius in that scene, then, would that be, he could be fulfilling both parts, then, right?
Well, he's known both parts. See, you know the story of Patricius?
Yeah.
Well, does everybody know that, so we don't need to...
He's everybody at once, spaghetti.
Well, no, I mean the history of him.
He's been both sexes.
Been both sexes.
Yeah.
In this poem, he symbolizes every character.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that? It's kind of funny that I remember in there's that old slang thing like if you masturbate, you go blind and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of funny that's how Tiresias got blind.
No. No. And we might have hairy palms. But No, Tiresias went blind because he was walking along through the woods and saw two snakes copulating, and he hit them with a staff, and then he was turned into a woman. And I think 7 years later, he went back and saw the same two snakes copulating again. He says, well, heck, if I hit them the first time and they went through that catastrophic change, I'll hit them again and see what that happened. Boom, he's back to a man. And he lived 7 years as a woman, and then he lived as a man. And so he experienced both sides of the thing. Then he was asked by Jove, do you know this part of it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I don't need to go on if you all know that.
I don't know.
I don't know. No? Then he was asked that Jove and Juno were having an argument. God and a goddess were having an argument. Who gets more enjoyment out of lovemaking, a man or a woman? Jove said, the man says that the woman gets more pleasure. And the woman said, no, it's vice versa. The man gets more pleasure. And so they saw Tiresias and they say, hey, this is a good arbiter because he's been both and he can say. And so he says, he sides with Jove, and he says the woman gets more pleasure out of lovemaking. So the goddess gets angry and zaps him, and he's blind. He says, okay, you know, zap, you're blind for the rest of your life. And then Jove says, well, gee, here you sided with me in the argument, and a god can't take away what a goddess does, and he couldn't take away the blindness. So he says, instead, I can't do that, but I can give you the power to foresee the future, and zap. And Tiresias says the power to foresee the future. Now, we remember this. Here, because what Tiresias sees is what's happening, but it's also foreseeing the future. And that's where this poem starts to get us. I mean, he's not just talking about a bunch of people. He's saying that grassroots philosophy of the country at the time and of our civilization at the time, this is what we've got to expect. This is what we've got to expect. This is what we're going. We're going in this direction. And he says, unless something happens, this is what we're going to have. The wasteland, more and more. You know, there was some then, and he's figuring it's more and more. And I can't see that it's been held back much, you know, in general, sort of looking at the whole world at once, or the whole country at once. It's more and more that way. More and more the automatic hand, more and more the record on the gramophone, more and more the vanity requires no response. So, he, you know, that's why I mentioned this here, that supposedly the woman, that's supposed to be an honest thing because Tiresias was both, and so the woman is supposed to have most, and the guy doesn't. If she has most, she has none, and the guy doesn't either. There's just nothing there. What connection do lines 292 and 305 have with 230 and 355? Well, let's see. Who is speaking? Well, another, what should I resent? Seduction. Now, Queen Elizabeth, that question, I think that some have said that that's Queen Elizabeth in the bar. I don't like that one too much. I was of that feeling even this month. I think we talked about that, didn't we, in English? And I don't know. After thinking about it, that isn't Queen Elizabeth. It's one of the river nymphs from before. And it's the river daughters, Susie Cream Cheese. Okay, death by water. What is that section? It's a short section. I don't really know what to do with that. Death by water is a translation of a part of a poem Eliot wrote in French. Why is it included in the poem? I don't know. But Eugenides, the Smyrna merchant, was a Phoenician with currants in his pocket. And this guy, Phlebas, is a Phoenician too, with currant in his pocket, but of a different kind. He's dead.
John, Tiro Christino's Phoenician sailor signify death by water.
Hmm?
Does Phoenician sailor and Tiro Christino signify death by water?
Yeah. So maybe the person at Madame Sesostris is Eugenides.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
okay.
That you're overhearing that. And the main thing there at that point is that it's talk about profit and loss, profit and loss, profit and loss. Okay, you've lived your life on profit and loss, and now you're down there with your getting your pocket picked in the bottom of the ocean. And just think, once this guy was as tall as you, you know, as brave and tall as you, or as handsome and tall as you. I think this is the weakest portion of the poem. It goes clunk and okay, so what? It doesn't really function for me that well. Except that the trade, profit and loss, comes of having your pocket, and then you live a life like that, and then you die, and you're having your pockets picked. And you were essentially having your pockets picked when alive, with the prostitute out at the whatever, so-and-so. It's a weak portion, except for the irony. Consider Phlebas, once handsome and tall as you. That's the only thing, you know. You're again invited into this. You're one like this. I mean, it ties you in. I didn't see anything more in that section, and I've tried, but I can't. Okay. How am I doing? Getting there. 328. 328, when you look at question 18 on the sheet, these I'm just going to, I didn't write out full answers because I think we can talk things together here a bit. But explain 328, where is it? He who was living is now dead. We who are living now are now dying with a little patience. Well, is it a slain fertility god that is dead and now, and there's no more chance to get him back again? Is it Christ's crucifixion that we're talking about? Is it a glorious past that's now dead and we're suffering through the present? Is it the lively past that's now dead and we're suffering through? Is Christ now dead, but it's before the resurrection? We walk stunned to Emmaus, learning, yearning for water, even a sound, walk road in thirst, towns turn upside down. We hope the cock crows a new day and means that we have a new day, means that we have new life. And not that the betrayal of Christ and the cock crowing. Now that brings up something that this poem is. It's important to know in this poem. It's equivocal. You can't nail anything down in one place, and he doesn't want you to. Is this this or this? Is this this or this? It's a sense of doubt that it creates in the wasteland. What's going up? What's really happening? What's really happening? Ambiguity. Is it Christ? No. Is it the Fisher King? No. Is it this? No. Is it that? No. But is it? And you go round and round and round. But where's the solid, you know, solid thing in here? You don't really have that much solid. Well, okay. What's he talking about? He who was living is now dead. God? Christ? Slain fertility God that he was going to try to heal? Is he gone? Well, we'll find that that's true at the end of this. Then the other question is, what are the references to Christ in the poem? We've talked about a number of those. And what does the thunder say? How does the speaker respond to each thing? Okay. After the torchlight red on sweaty faces, and this is like a nightmare, right? Nightmare that ends with a full statement. Well, it's a nightmare that ends, let's say. After the torchlight red on sweaty faces, after the frosty silence in the gardens, after the agony in stony places, the shouting and the crying, prison and palace and reverberation of thunder of spring over distant mountains, maybe we'll have some rain, finally, in the wasteland. After all this, and now we have the thunder of spring over distant mountains, he who was living is now dead. We who were living are now dying with a little patience. Ufta. Here is no water, but only rock. Rock and no water. And the sandy road, the road winding above the mountains, which are mountains of rock without water. If there were water, we should stop and drink amongst the rock. One cannot stop or think. Sweat is dry and feet are in the sand. If there were only water amongst the rock, dead mountain, mouth of carious teeth that cannot spit. Ufta, what an image. There's no longer here fear of water, which you had earlier. Earlier there was the fear of water, the fear of the lively. Now it's gotten so low, so bad, that the fear is not there anymore. Give me water. Somewhere. If there were water, we should stop and drink. Amongst the rock, one cannot stop or think. If there were only water amongst the rock, dead mountain, mouth of carious teeth that cannot spit. Here, one can neither stand nor lie nor sit. There is not even silence in the mountains, but the dry, sterile thunder without rain. Up, the hope, down, crunch. There is not even solitude in the mountains, but red, sullen faces sneer and snarl from doors of mud-cracked houses. Ufta. If there were water and no rock, if there were rock and also water, and water, a spring, a pool among the rock, if there were the sound of water only, anything, just the sound, so starved and so sterile a world, if there were the sound of water only, not the cicada, you know that what a cicada sounds like, you guys? Cicada? Yeah, okay, you know what a June bug sounds like after it hits the lights and it's down underneath the lights in the streets, kind of like that? That's what a cicada sounds like. The dry grass singing, but sound of water over a rock where the hermit thrush sings in the pine trees, drip, drop, drip, drop, 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 drop. The only thing of water is a bird, and it sounds like water, Chinese water torture to me. But there is no water. Who is the third who walks always beside you? When I count, there are only you and I together. But when I look up ahead, up the white road, there is always another one walking beside you, gliding, wrapped in a brown mantle, hooded. I do not know whether a man or a woman. But who is that on the other side of you? Is this the Christ that they cannot recognize? That's one of the accepted ideas here. That they're on the road. I know not whether man or woman would make you think that it could be Tiresias, who kind of carries everything, doesn't he? He carries all the people, and maybe is the Christ here. Maybe his footnote doesn't help much, does it? In Antarctica, two guys were walking along, and they always saw another one. Thanks a lot, Elliot. What is that sound high in the air? Murmur of maternal lamentation. Love that line, murmur of maternal lamentation. Who are these hooded hordes swarming over endless plains, stumbling in cracked earth, ringed by the flat horizon only? What is the city over the mountains? You get a picture of the Huns coming here. What are those hooded hordes swarming over endless plains, going to make the world be a place that is like the red sullen faces sneer and snarl from doors of mud-cracked houses, and you get the whole civilization going down the tubes. Black riders, yeah. What is the city over the mountains? Cracks and reforms and bursts in the violent air. A reforms there is a neat double meaning. Reforms, normally you think of things getting, better. And you cracks and reforms, and probably cracks and reforms. And what is cracking and reforming here? It's all the top best cities, the hope cities of civilization. You go from Jerusalem, Athens, Alexandria, Vienna, London, unreal. Each falls, reforms, falls in a new, reforms in a new way, falls again. this continual falling of civilization, and he's sort of prefiguring that this is London, huh? London is the one that's falling down now, and that's what we're seeing. A woman drew her, this is all nightmare though, right? It's a long nightmare. A woman drew her long black hair out tight and fiddled whisper music on those strings, and bats with baby faces in the violet light whistled and beat their wings and crawled head downward toward a, down a blackened wall, and upside down in air were towers. You know, we've talked about living right side up in an upside down world. Well, this is, everything is upside down. Upside down in the air were towers tolling reminiscent bells that kept the hours and voices singing out of empty cisterns and exhausted wells. And that's from, I think, Jeremiah. No,
yeah.
It's from
Jeremiah.
Is it Jeremiah? Where you guys have carved, you've turned down the living water and you've carved cisterns for yourselves, broken cisterns that hold no water. And you've turned down the living water that is God. Voices singing out of the empty cisterns which they have carved for themselves and the exhausted wells. In this decayed hole among the mountains, in the faint moonlight, the grass is singing over the tumbled graves about the chapel. There is the empty chapel, only the wind's home. Well, in being with the Fisher King myth, the finally got to the Chapel Perilous, you know, is going to go there and everything's going to be all right and it's empty. Crash again. Down he goes again. There, it has no windows, and the door swings. Dry bones can harm no one. Only a cock stood on the roof tree. Cocorico, cocorico. In the flash of lightning, then a damp gust bringing rain. Oh boy, it's going to be good. Here comes a damp gust. Ganges, the Ganges was sunken, and the limp leaves waited for rain. And we, all of a sudden we jump out. We jump out again. The Ganges was sunken, and the limp leaves waited for rain, while the black clouds gathered far distant over Himavant, probably the Himalayas, I don't know. The jungle crouched, humped in silence. The jungle crouched, humped in silence. Does that remind you of anything that we've read? Golding's Thinking is a Hobby. Remember putting the panther up behind the thinker's back?
Mm-hmm.
And the dark jungles are behind us. The poem by Yeats. The poem by Yeats is The Second Coming. You know that, anyone? Mm-hmm. Second Coming, the crude beast. The poem talks about the Second Coming. Christ is going to come again. Instead of Christ coming again, it's the one. It's the lion sphinx is going. The crude beast is coming. You know, slouching toward Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. The Second Coming is going to be the barbarous age.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The jungle crouched, humped in silence. Then spoke the thunder. Da. About this period, Dadaism started in art, by the way. I don't know if that makes sense. Dadaism is nonsense art. Da. And that's interpreted in the myth, or the Eastern myth, as Data, which means give. What have we given? Now, this is the secret that they get. Now, the thunder speaks and gives the secret for getting out of the wasteland. And it says give, and it says sympathize, and it says control. And I think my question was, how does the poet at this point respond to that? Give. What have we given? My friend, blood shaking my heart, the awful daring of a moment's surrender which an age of prudence can never retract, by this and this only we have existed, which is not to be found in our obituaries or in memories draped by the beneficent spider or under seals broken by the lean solicitor in our empty rooms. What has he said about giving? How has he responded to that? One of the questions. How has he responded to that?
It's too late.
Too late? Too late? Is the time element in there? Sounds pretty positive. My friend, blood shaking the heart, the awful daring of a moment's surrender which an age of prudence can never retract. By this and this only we have existed, which is not to be found in my obituaries. I remember in Straight by the Magnificent Spider. We're back to Proof Rock, actually, I think here. We can't give. We can't give. We don't have the guts. We're locked in an age of prudence. We don't have the guts. Love can't escape Bostonian prison of reserve. Nerve fails. Nerve fails. You tell us to give. Well, to give, we have to make a real, you know, we have to risk. we can't risk. Well then, sympathize. The second thing the thunder says, sympathize. I have heard the key turn in the door once, and turn once only. We think of the key, each in his prison. Thinking of the key, each confirms a prison. Only at nightfall, ethereal rumors revive for a moment a broken Coriolanus. What's that? Sympathize? How well can we sympathize? To sympathize, what do we have to do?
Get outside yourself.
Get outside yourself. We think of a key to get outside of ourselves. Once there was a key, what was the key to get outside of yourself? Yeah, that's why the question follows. I mean, it's this key to get outside yourself. Once there was a key, but now no more. Because that key is not a key. That king is dead. The king my brother is dead. The king my father before him is dead. There's this lack. It was a key. I have heard the key turn in the door once. But it didn't turn all the way, and turn only once, it won't turn again. There's another way of looking at that too. If you want, turn once and it turned to lock it. Yeah. But the key to open would be getting out of yourself, would be the Christ. We think of the key, each in his prison. Thinking of the key, each confirms a prison. Only at nightfall, our ethereal rumors receive for a moment a broken Coriolanus. Now, I really don't quite understand the Coriolanus bit, because Coriolanus is the hero of the play, Coriolanus, and he is a great general in Rome, and then he, out of pride, rather than duty or common sense, he leaves the troops, joins some other troops that are going to attack Rome, and then decides, is told to not, I mean, is convinced by somebody, a Roman mother or his mother, I can't remember, not to fight Rome, and so he says, okay, I won't, and then he is eventually killed by the guys that he was originally fighting.
Didn't he start out by he gave,
and then his pride stopped him, because the mob was not appreciative.
Appreciative.
Okay, now we're getting to the point, I thank you.
Mm-hmm.
But sympathize, and he gave, and in sympathy, and then he wasn't appreciated, and so, yeah, then he quit. And then he relented, and then he was killed. Well, it isn't really possible, except in dreams sometimes. Sometimes we can almost sympathize at night, but not in the real day. Control, the next one, da, control, damyata. The boat responded gaily to the hand expert with sail or oar. The sea was calm. Your heart would have been, you would have responded gaily when invited, beating obedient to controlling hands. Control is referred, it means self-control, right? As a secret, self-control. Okay, the boat responded gaily to the hand expert with sail and oar. The sea was calm, your heart would have responded gaily when invited, beating obedient to controlling hands. Is that talking about self-control? Beating obedient to controlling hands. They're talking about self-control. They're talking about
external
control, sort of giving up control. Remember, now we're going to read Brothers Karamazov for the next month. I mean, coming up. What is the one thing that people want to give up more from the Grand Inquisitor chapter? Man is in a mad rush to give up his freedom. Even our most of our statements that we think are for freedom are to give up freedom. Eventually, are giving up our freedom. To be controlled, to not be held responsible, and so forth. Well, this would be the boat responded gaily to the hand expert with sailor oar. Who's expert with sailor oar? If the boat is the life, no one. Does Elliot know how to row a boat? No.
Elliot know how to row a boat? No. For one, the sea was calm. Your heart would have responded gaily when invited, beating obedient to controlling hand. You'd rather do it that way. Well, so what happens? I sat upon the shore, fishing with the arid plain behind me. Fishing with the arid plain behind me. That comes from the Fisher King myth. Now get ready. I sat upon the shore, fishing with the arid plain behind me. That's from the Fisher King. Shall I at least set my lands in order? That's an ironic take off something from Dante, and I think from Dante.
Yeah.
It says, you know, oh God, set my love in order. What's become of that now? Oh, let's set my land in order. Now that's a sort of a thing that I held up first time I read. They says, hey, that's a neat line. I put my land in order, you know. And it is, in a sense. I mean, as we do have, you know, we are in situations, and we put that, our situations in order, our states of affairs in order. But it's a far cry from asking God to help us put our love in order. London Bridge is falling down, falling down, falling down. So the church, you know, a child's song, coming from the age when London Bridge was falling down, an old time one. And I think that was during the fires, deposed time. The next one means he hid himself in the fire that refines them. Somehow there's some kind of hope of refining here, but I don't really know where. I mean, it's said, but I don't see it happening. He's going through seeing this. Somehow he's sort of, you know, tasting all the bitterness of the world, and that's a kind of a refining. I mean, he's through something in some sense. Working his way through. He finds out that there's nothing there. He can't do any of the things that the thunder says, that God says for him to do. Well, I'll sit and put my lands in order. And this thing purifying possibly could happen. And quando fiam, that statement is, when shall I be as to swallow? When shall I be as to swallow? You go back to the Philomel myth, perhaps, in that. Then the Prince of Aquitaine in the ruined tower. Well, that's an interesting one. That goes back to the ruined tower, the ruined what? The ruined city, the ruined
civilization,
the ruined tradition, the ruined things of beauty. There's a neat footnote on that. It's in this book, I think. In this sonnet, that's quoted from the sonnet, and in that sonnet, the title which is Spanish for the disinherited one, De Nuevo represents himself as the neglected and outcast heir of the imaginative tradition of the troubadour poets. Hence he refers to himself, the line quoted by Eliot, as the Prince of Aquitaine, the ruined tower, that the outcast heir of a tradition, you know, in poetry, and ways of meaning, and he's the outcast heir to this as a poet. Yeah, it's from the that's the line from the poem, and Eliot is in a sense this too. Now, because the way he follows the next line, these fragments I have shored against my ruin, it's all busted apart. All of my reference points are busted apart. I have these fragments that have appeared, these quotes and so forth from the whole thing. He's short against his ruins. He's gotten these up there. But is that a positive image? I'll put my land in order. I'll shore up these ruins, you know, with these fragments. I've short against my ruins. And then he goes nuts at the end, huh? Why, then I'll fit you. Hieronymo's mad again. Give, sympathize, control, but already he's shown that he can't do it. But then he gives a benediction that no one understands. That no one can understand. It's like, what can I do? Well, I'll tell you what you can do. Thanks a lot. And does it leave on a positive note? Now, it has been thought that it does leave on a positive note. Oh, this benediction means, you know, he surpasses understanding, but no one knows what that means until you look it up in a footnote and so forth. Well, you get the sense that this poem is spoken, and it is. I mean, it's written by someone, and they are saying this. Okay, you're not with the benefit of the footnotes, and so you come along, you know, I sat upon the shore fishing with the arid plain behind me. Now, you had hope there for a while, the gust of rain, and the thunder says, give, sympathize, control, that's the only hope that you've got. He shows right there you can't do it. Then he says, I sat upon the shore fishing, the arid plain behind me. The gods have left me. My hope is gone. At least I can put my lands in order. What are his land? His fragments up against his ruins. He's saying, what do we do at the end of the poem, the high point? What are you going to do? You get a pithy little statement like, I shall set my lands in order. Proverb. London Bridge is falling down, falling down, falling down. Blah, 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 blah. One language. Blah, 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 blah. Oh, swallow, swallow. Blah, 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 blah. In another language. These fragments I have shored against my ruins. Why then I'll fit you, Hieronymus mad again. Dada, dayadvam, damyada, shanti, shanti, shanti. That's the end. Yeah. Where's the hope? Where's the hope? Well, he does do dada, dayadvam, damyata, but if you look it up, you can find give, sympathize, control. He already shows that the man by his own strength doesn't have enough strength to do it. Can't do it. Can't approach doing it by yourself. And yet the hangman is dead. The hangman is dead. I mean, gone. Christ is gone. There's no Christ here. And all we're left with is ourselves. And we can't handle it by ourselves. Now, there's a neat thing on this thing. Why, then I'll pitch you the story of the footnote on that from the play, The Spanish Tragedy. Hieronymo's mad because his son is killed. He writes a play where the guilty are players in the play, and he wants to get them killed in the play. He writes it so that they get killed. In a sense, Eliot kills off all his characters in this thing for killing his being, killing his tradition, killing his world. What has become of it? And he gets these guys in there. Okay, you guys have done it. And he kills them. That's pretty far out interpretation, but I think you can run with it. That's one of many. There are many interpretations at this point. Hieronymo's mad again. And then he jumps from about, I think there are probably four languages at least back there. And that, blah, 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 Hieronymo's mad again, which is the subtitle to the Spanish Tragedy. Is there a hope in that? No. But I think, and was Eliot a Christian when he wrote it? There's a lot of Christian stuff in there. I mean, mention of Christ symbols in there. No, he was not a Christian at the time. But he saw the world in such a way that he recognized, well, let's see, by himself, I can't do it. And you finally realize that by yourself, you can't do it. It's a matter of time until you cut your throat. Or become a Christian. Because these cisterns that we carve out for ourselves, and I think one of the best images I've ever had for a solely intellectual life, and this is one that Carol gave, it's like dropping a bucket down a bottomless well. It's that empty cistern and the well's without water. And you keep saying, well, there's hope, sure, this is a well, I can see that this is a well, and I'm going to put my bet here. You know, 80 years later, I have no water. I've wasted my life. I've wasted my hours, as Da Vinci said when he died. I want to read one little thing. How am I doing? 2 minutes. Late. I'm led to comment that perhaps if we do not, and this is working within the questing knight thing, the myth of the Fisher King is important to this poem in some ways. There are many forms of the myth, and some the Fisher King dies, and some he has an incurable illness. And some he is stricken with impotence. Whatever the case, the affliction leads to drought, desolation, and an inability to reproduce among man and beast. Anthony Burgess does a good job with this in a book called The Wanting Sea. Kingdom can only be saved if a questing knight goes to the Chapel Perilous, situated in the heart of the wasteland, and there asks certain questions about the Grail and the Lance, originally fertility symbols, female and male, respectively. The proper asking of these questions revives the king and restores the fertility to to the land. Now I'm going to go way off here. I'm led to comment that perhaps if we do not ask the right questions concerning men and women, beginning with ourselves, the Christ in us remains impotent in our lives, which remain desolate and without power to regenerate our lives. We go to the chapel perilous, which we may call conviction of sin. Who is there to ask the question of? I think Christ is there at that chapel, conviction of our sin, and never in just a chapel. It's perilous to go to the cross. We find the Fisher King there, the very Lord we would heal, but to bring fertility and potency to our lives and land. It is a paradox that we must ask the questions of the man we would take down from the cross and into our lives. I think the answer to this paradox would be revealed. The first question we must ask of the man nailed to the cross is again paradoxically, help me. The question asked of him is also the answer. Yes, I will. The King in us would revive asking this question, the proper question at the Chapel Perilous. Our lives would take root in him and somehow grow, and there would be fruit again in the wasteland. Now, Eliot did not mean what I've just said when he wrote The Wasteland. He was not a Christian, but he flirted with Buddhism then, at the time of the writing. I do feel this poem, though, foreshadows his conversion to Christianity. All he has at the end are fragments that he has shored against his ruin. His only answer is in a foreign language we don't know. It is indeed a peace that passes understanding. Shanti, Indata, Dayadvan, Tamyata. Eliot stacks the deck against his peace, which remains in ruins at the end of his poem. And there really isn't hope at the end of that. Conversation about this poem will continue. It has. It will continue. And as you get questions going in your head and about any parts of this or something, we perhaps can meet again. I have this meeting to go to. And that's a pretty quick thing. Yeah, we are. Great Divorce tomorrow night. Taped by Walt Bowman, and then we'll talk about it. It's not something I'm not doing a great deal with it. I'll make one comment if no one else makes it. Dynamite. No. But
you want to?
Yes, I'd like to have these.
Some will read them back.
Uh-huh. If you put your names on them. Oh, forgot one thing.
Oh.
You want to hear. Oh, darn it. Ezra Pound edited this thing for Eliot, and cut the Hollow Men and one other poem of Eliot's out of it. He says, oh no, get this out of that. And this is what he cut out too. This is what Eliot was going to use as the start of his poem. The original title for The Wasteland was He Do the Police in Different Voices.
He Do the Police in Different Voices.
Yeah. He Do the Police in Different Voices. And the start of the section, Burial of the Dead, went like this. First we had a couple of feelers down at Tom's place. There was old Tom, boiled to the eyes, blind. Don't you remember that time after the dance, top hats and all, and silk hat Harry and old Tom took us out and brought out a bottle of fizz with old Jane, Tom's wife, and we got Joe to sing, I'm proud of all the Irish blood that's in me. There's not a man to say a word again me. Then we had dinner in good form and a couple of Bengal lights. Then we got down in the show, and up in row A, I tried to put my foot in the drum, and didn't the girl squeal? She never did take to me, a nice guy, but rough. The next thing we were out in the street. Oh, was it cold? When will you be good? Blew in the opera exchange, sopped up some gin, sat in the court game. Mr. Fay was there singing The Maid of the Mill. Then we thought we'd breeze along and take a walk. Then we lost Steve. I think I turned up an hour later down at Myrtle's place. What do you mean, she says, at 2 o'clock in the morning? I'm not in business here for you guys like you. We've only had a raid last week. I've been warned twice. I've kept a decent house for 20 years. There's three gents from the Buckingham Club upstairs now. I'm going to retire and live on a farm, she says. There's no money in it now with all the damage done and the reputation the place gets off a few barflies. I kept a clean house for 20 years, she says, and the gents from the Buckingham Club know that they're safe here. You was well introduced, but this is the last of you. Get me a woman, I said. You're too drunk, she said. But she gave me a bed and a bath and ham and eggs. And now you get a shave, she said. Myrtle always treats me white. We had just gone up the alley. A fly cop came along looking for trouble. Committed a nuisance, he said. You come on to the station. I'm sorry, I said. It's no use being sorry, he said. Let me get my hat, I said. Well, by stroke of luck, who came but Mr. Donovan? What's this, officer? You knew on this beat, ain't you? I thought so. You should have... You know who I am? Yes, I do, said the fresh cop, very peevish. Then let it alone. These gents are particular friends of mine. Wasn't it luck? Then we went to the German club. We and Mr. Donovan and his friend Lee Leakey found it shut. I want to get home, said the cabman. We all go the same way home, said Mr. Donovan. Cheer up, Trixie and Stella, and put his foot through the window. The next I knew, the old cab was hauled up at the avenue, and the cabman and little Ben leaving the tailor, the one who read George Meredith. We were running 100 yards on a bet, and Mr. Donovan holding his watch, so I got out to see the sunrise and walked home. April is the cruelest month, leading desire out of the... Wasn't it nice that Pound told him to cut that out?
Yes, yeah.
Cut it out. Isn't that nuts? You know? That's what's neat. A whole book has come out about Ezra Pound's part in this poem, and it is major.
Is Elliot the one that went into the inkling?
No. Yeah, Elliot's one of them who did want to get into the inkling. And Auden, too. But neither, both of them are just kids. Just young punks.
Oh,